From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. At the White House this morning, President Trump pushed back on claims that he's limiting the scope of the week-long FBI investigation into Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
I want it to be comprehensive. I actually think it's a good thing for Judge Kavanaugh. I think it's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. Now, with that being said, I'd like it to go quickly.
Kavanaugh's nomination is on hold until the FBI investigates allegations of sexual assault against him. Let's bring in Chad Pergram, who covers Congress for Fox News. Chad, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So there have been questions about the scope of this investigation. Did the president tell us anything new about who's in control and what the terms are?
Well, he indicated, quote, I want to make the Senate happy. And I've been told here in the past hour and 15 minutes or so that by one senior Republican Senate source that they think they could wrap this up, by tomorrow. But they can't be viewed as rushing this. Remember, the terms of the agreement laid out by Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona on Friday, was that this was supposed to take a week. Now, let me get a little bit into the weeds here, and this is very important on Senate procedure. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has a right to file what's called cloture. That's an effort to end debate. And whenever he does that, consider that to be day one. A confirmation vote after you run through all the Senate traps would be on about day four, maybe day five.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch McConnell really can't do that until Wednesday at the earliest. The question is, if he goes ahead before the FBI investigation is complete, is he interrupting this agreement with Jeff Flake, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska? If they are okay with that and they're like, yes, okay, this is satisfied, it hasn't been a week, that's fine, let's go ahead, then everybody is cool with that. That's fine. But if he's perceived as jumping the gun, that's a problem. That could be viewed as a violation of the agreement.
Hmm.
And, you know, Jeff Flake got a lot of criticism from some conservatives over the weekend who criticized him for saying that, you know, he was delaying all this. They wouldn't have a chance at getting the votes to confirm Brett Kavanaugh were it not for Jeff Flake. They're basically sitting right now at about 49 yeas. And with this deal, they could potentially get Collins, potentially get Murkowski, maybe Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, maybe Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota, maybe get as high as 53 yeas, but otherwise they're stuck at 49. So they can't move too quickly in the Senate. They have to be very careful.
The president says he wants what Senate leadership wants. So the question is, what does Senate leadership want? I mean, who is on that list of people that will be interviewed by the FBI?
And that's the question. What does Collins want? What does Murkowski want? That is a big unknown. And that's why, Senate timing around here is not exactly Swiss. When they tell you that something is going to happen 7 days from now or 6 days from now, it usually happens in about 8 or 9, maybe 10. The only thing I do know is that once that clock starts to run,
mm-hmm.
once McConnell files cloture to end debate, that will take, that's a finite period, about 4 to 5 days at the most. So we don't know, and that's something that they have to consider and see where they are. And did they find out any answers that raised other questions? We're not privy to what they're finding out in this background investigation.
Right, and if the FBI does get information that puts off a light bulb in their heads, are they allowed to follow the leads that they get, or is that within the scope of this deal that's been laid out? Like, can the FBI follow up?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that most senators wanting to do due diligence would probably be okay with. I was struck by something else in the remarks by the president, and he was struck by this, in fact, from the testimony from Brett Kavanaugh last Thursday. The president said, quote, I was surprised at how vocal he was about the fact that he liked beer.
Hmm.
And that's become, kind of this meme now around Brett Kavanaugh and is somewhat central to this investigation. I'm going to point back to a Senate confirmation that blew up. In 1989, John Tower, former Republican senator from Texas, who President Bush 41 had nominated to be defense secretary. Now, there were a lot of questions and allegations lobbed at John Tower that he was a womanizer, that he wasn't conservative enough. And one of the issues was that he had a problem with alcohol. And John Tower was ultimately defeated. He did not become defense secretary. And Dick Cheney became the defense secretary.
And one of Kavanaugh's former classmates, friends at Yale, says he's going to go to the FBI today and submit a statement that says when Kavanaugh was drinking in college, he was belligerent. So you're saying that might matter?
You see, and this is where, you start to go down these different rabbit holes. When they agreed to this delay on Friday of a week's time, Time is the enemy to Brett Kavanaugh, because you don't know what else can come out. You don't know what else you learn. Maybe it actually, you know, corroborates or is exculpatory evidence. You don't really know. But any time that you haven't wrapped things up, that's a problem. There's an old saying in the Senate that nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed to. And they are far away from having everything agreed to with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Big week ahead. Chad Pergram covers Congress for Fox News. Chad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, in Washington, President Trump today announced a new trade deal to succeed the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA.
So we have negotiated this new agreement based on the principle of fairness and reciprocity. To me, it's the most important word in trade, because we've been treated so unfairly by so many nations all over the world, and we're changing that.
Let's bring in Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And President Trump called this a historic transaction. He is calling it the United States-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement. How big of a change is it really, though? How different is it from NAFTA?
It's different-ish. It makes it easier for dairy farmers to sell into Canada, and it makes it easier, or harder, I should say, for car companies to outsource their work to Mexico. So if you're a dairy farmer in the U.S., or if you work in the auto manufacturing industry, particularly if you're in a auto manufacturing union, this deal is probably going to help you. But the big picture here, as I see it, is that Trump in the campaign 2016 didn't say, I think NAFTA could use a minor tweak. He said NAFTA was the worst trade deal in world history. And this basically keeps the parameters of NAFTA with several new benefits for certain groups. So, you know, to me, this is a bit like saying LaGuardia Airport is the worst airport in the world, and then opening a food court in Terminal A and saying, look, I built you a new airport. Like, look, there's nothing wrong with a food court, and there's nothing wrong with opening up access to selling, you know, milk products in Canada. But this is not a new trade deal. This is not a new thing. This is basically NAFTA 2.0.
But are his supporters going to view it that way, or is this a win as far as they're concerned?
Yeah, I mean, if his supporters are dairy farmers, they're going to be happy. If his supporters work in the car manufacturing industry, I'm sure they're going to be happy. You know, in terms of the biggest losers here, it's not yet entirely clear. I think that people who support Donald Trump, it has been shown in poll after poll, they basically support him no matter what. And this isn't a bad trade deal. It's a fine trade deal. It's just extremely subtle compared with the criticisms that Trump had for the previous trade deal. And it should be said that in 2016, as a part of the TPP negotiations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, Obama's team was negotiating with Canada and Mexico and actually extracted many of the exact same benefits that Trump has now extracted from those countries in 2018. And so I think the confusion here for a lot of economists, if you're going to take Trump seriously when he criticizes NAFTA, when he pulls out of TPP as he did in his first week as president, is if there was all this bluster about how bad these trade agreements are, and then 2 years later you're basically just reenacting them and putting a new name on it, then what exactly we've been talking about for the last year and a half?
Well, what does it mean for the manufacturing industry in this country, which President Trump has been focused on since before he became president? He's been telling people in a lot of states in the Midwest, especially, that, you know, we're going to bring your jobs back. We're going to the manufacturing industry in this country is going to boom again.
Right. So on the one hand, it's important to say the steel tariffs remain in place. They might open up more negotiations in the future with Canada. But for now, the steel tariffs remain in place, and that's something that the steel manufacturing industry quite likes. But whenever we're talking about manufacturing, it's important to say, let's define what a comeback is. In 1979, there were 20 million manufacturing workers. When Trump became president, there were 12.3 million. Now there's 12.7 million. Right? So we've added 400,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 18 months. That's not bad. Manufacturing jobs are coming back, but we're never going to have anything close to the 1970s economy again. And so, you know, when I talk to economists about, you know, how do you plan the economy of the future? They say, well, plan for the economy of the future. Don't try to create conditions to grasp for the economy that we had in 1979. And so it just seems like there's an enormous amount of effort being placed on creating conditions for the revitalization of a tiny, tiny part of the U.S. economy, which is in steel manufacturing.
Well, and in fact, we were just in Indiana recently doing some reporting on manufacturing there. And one of the problems that they say that they have in the industry there is, you know, we've got the jobs. We just don't have workers that are trained to do the new manufacturing jobs. Derek, just in the 30 seconds that we have left here, what do you think that this news about the U.S., what do we call it, USMCA,
USMCA.
The new NAFTA. What does that mean for countries that the U.S. government is still in sort of trade disputes with? I'm thinking about the European Union in particular.
The European Union and China. You know, if this gives Trump confidence that his trade strategy is working, that might embolden him to hold out on China. It might embolden him to hold out on the European Union as well. On the other hand, if you take the outcome of this negotiation on its face, then you say Trump is going to have a lot of bluster. There's going to be a lot of criticism of the status quo, but you're going to end up with the status quo. I mean, to be clear, USMCA, NAFTA 2.0, whatever you call it, it's basically exactly what the Obama administration had toward the end of 2016. And so if that's your precedent, then you're going to have a lot of bluster, but end up essentially where we were 2 years ago.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Activists blocked major highways and rail lines in the Catalonia region of northeast Spain today. They're still fighting for independence 1 year after a historic referendum, which the Spanish government called illegal and invalid. In fact, the government tried to stop the election from even happening. Police fought with voters as they cast their ballots on October 1st, 2017. Joining us now is the BBC's Gavin Lee. He's in a busy square in downtown Barcelona where there was a moment of silence at noon local time to mark the anniversary of that vote. Gavin, tell us more about what's happening there today.
Well, I think what we're seeing has become sort of the most effective tool of the independence movement, which is their physical numbers, the colours on the streets, the flags, the Estelada, the flag of independence. And there are people who are all around me, hundreds of mainly young independence activists who have been sleeping outside the Catalan Parliament, saying that for the next few weeks and months they're going to try and protect the general state of the government, the regional government, until they declare independence. So they could be here for some time.
Well, let's hear from one of the activists that you spoke with. This is a man named Roger Espanyol, who was shot by police in the eye. He was blinded by a rubber bullet last October 1st, and you asked him what has been achieved by the referendum.
The first step was the 1st of October, and I'm sure we're going to make it, yes. Even if we don't have the political power in our sight.
Gavin, do these protesters believe they still have a shot at independence?
Some of them do. One of the grassroots group called the CDR, sort of Campaign for a Democratic Republic, who this morning cut some of the major motorway routes into Barcelona, stopped all the traffic. They managed to break into the train station, stop the high-speed train running from one of the major cities to Barcelona. You know, they are active, and the new regional president, a man called Quim Torra, has said today that this activity is working. Keep pushing it. So I think this will be seen as provocative, certainly by the main government in Spain. You know, they are saying, the socialist government and the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, there is no chance of ever a referendum on independence. It's against the constitution, but they could have greater autonomy. And last night I put that to the spokesperson for the Catalan separatist government here, and Joan Maria Piqué. He said to me categorically no, and they will continue, he said, working on acts of disobedience like the illegal referendum if they don't get an independence choice. Now I said when and how. He said not now, I'm not telling you. We'll do something.
Well, now we should point out that there are recent polls that say that people in the region are split on the issue. So there are many people that you've been speaking to still want independence, and there are those who do not. How divided is Catalonia?
Well, I think that's the fascinating thing, because in the year since that we had a really pivotal moment, the polls haven't changed. It's divided 50-50. And I think that's the interesting thing, when a lot of the analysts who look at the situation now, they believe the one thing that's increased is the bitterness between both sides, and that exactly, you nailed it, that divided, fragile sense, it could very easily spark off again on the streets.
That's the BBC's Gavin Lee speaking with us from the streets of downtown Barcelona. Gavin, thanks so much for your time. We do appreciate it.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, now that we're into fall and the weather's a little cooler, here and now resident chef Kathy Gunst is here to warm us up with some fried chicken. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Jeremy.
And fried chicken is one of those foods that we love to eat, but we don't always love to make.
I know. And you know what? I'm going to be really honest. Mm-hmm. I spend week after week in this studio telling you how simple it is to make various foods. And I'm not lying. But I will tell you the truth that fried chicken, it is involved. Deep frying at home is completely doable, but it's involved.
Well, I would be afraid I would start a fire.
You wouldn't start a fire, but you want to hear my first tip?
Yeah.
I use a wok. A wok is the ideal shape for holding the oil, no splattering. It's got the high sides. You want to always work with about 1 to 2 inches of oil. Mm. You want to keep a thermometer, because you want to constantly be monitoring the temperature of the oil.
And you put that thermometer in the hot oil.
Right. So I have my wok. I also use a cast iron skillet.
Okay.
I add about 1 to 2 inches of, I like to use a combination of an organic shortening. Some people use Crisco. You can use safflower oil, canola oil. I like to do a mix, and I bring it up to 325. And because my thermometer is right there, I can constantly see, whoa, 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 it's getting close to 400. Or, oh, no, it's down to 200. And I am always adjusting.
You want to keep it around 325.
325. The highest you want to get is 350. Otherwise, you're going to have some burnt chicken.
Okay, let's get to the results here. You have some buttermilk fried chicken.
I do. This is my nod to Southern fried chicken, American South.
Oh, I can listen to that crunch.
All right,
not sure if
you
good. Can hear that, but.
Oh, just pick it up. Forget the fork. what I did was I took a whole chicken, I cut it into 8 pieces, and I marinated it overnight in really good buttermilk, salt, pepper, and a dash of cayenne.
Mm.
And buttermilk tenderizes chicken. It adds some of that acidic flavor, but it also does tenderize the chicken. I take it out, and then I dust it well in a combination of flour and cornmeal. And those little specks you see, I used a very coarse gristmill ground cornmeal. So it's got a great texture. And then I fry it up. And here's another trick, okay?
Okay.
If you're frying a whole chicken, you're going to do all the wings at first.
Okay.
Then you're going to do the thighs. Then you're going to do the breast pieces. Because each one of those cuts cooks for a different amount of time. And if you only have one type of part of the chicken in there, you're not going to over or undercook it.
Now, you've got a little bit of honey here and some lemon. So am I
do.
Supposed to – would you use that on the fried chicken?
I like that a lot. I like the way the lemon cuts the fattiness of the fried chicken, and I love the way the honey adds a sweetness to the buttermilk-drenched fried chicken. Mm. You'll see that in the South. This would be the perfect kind of chicken for waffles and chicken, for a fried chicken sandwich, right?
With the honey.
Isn't the honey? Because
really
it brings
good.
Out this sweet flavor that's there, but it's subtle, and it kind of pulls it out. That's a really favorite recipe.
By the way, what do you do with the leftover oil after you're done? Can you use that again?
You can fry more than one chicken in the oil. So yesterday I fried 2 whole chickens in my oil, and I did not keep it because I did answer the phone and the oil got a little hot at the end and was a little bit too brown. But the idea behind having not greasy food is that you're monitoring your oil and that you're using fresh oil after every 1 or 2 fryings.
Okay, there's another piece of fried chicken here, but it has got something else on top of it, some sesame seeds.
Exactly. This is my version, and I will not claim it to be authentic, of Korean fried chicken.
Ooh.
And what I did with this was I marinated the chicken in Korean chili paste. I hope I say this right, gochujang. And soy sauce, ginger, little ketchup, sesame, and scallion. Took it out of the marinade and dusted it in a combination of flour and cornstarch. And then you deep fry it. Oh, I forgot to mention something really important.
What?
This is double fried.
Ooh.
So you fry it. You cool it down,
and then you fry it again
for about 2 minutes on each side for that extra crispiness.
Oh, that's just for crispiness.
That is, yeah. It's not that you didn't cook it fully. It's that you want that extra crispiness. Then I made a sauce out of the marinade. I simmer it down again, the chili paste, the ginger, and I spread that on the chicken and dust it with sesame seeds. And I don't know. What do you think?
It's delicious. And
slightly
by the way,
authentic.
Well, and I remember we talked to David Chang, the chef of Momofuku,
mm-hmm.
about fried chicken. He mentioned there's a lot of history involving fried chicken when it comes to African Americans. I've also eaten at Pascal's in Atlanta, which is where Martin Luther King used to go and have his fried chicken back in the day. So there's a lot of history to
this. And David Chang did a whole series for Netflix about,
right.
he did a whole episode on fried chicken. And what the big takeaway is that it's eaten all over the world.
Right.
I did talk to Michael Twitty. He is the author of The Cooking Gene, which won some James Beard Awards. He said, fried chicken goes back deep into the Middle Ages in Africa during the slave trade. It's emblematic of the Afro-Creole innovation that gets co-opted time and time again. And he goes on to talk about how it's Southern and the soul identities come right out of this collision of all the influences that make up the fried chicken that we eat in this country that we so adore.
Okay, there's one more thing in front of me, Kathy, and this is buffalo chicken wings.
It is. Buffalo chicken wings, of course, originally came from Buffalo. They are traditionally fried. However, even though we're calling this a segment on fried chicken, I baked these.
Ooh.
Because I know there are going to be listeners who are like, yum, that sounds so good. I'd like to go to our house and eat it, but no way am I making
it. I'm not
going to
make it. Right.
So these are baked at a very high temperature. You take the chicken wings, you toss them with some olive oil, garlic, cayenne, then you roast them at a very high heat till they get crispy, and then you make a very simple sauce with ketchup and vinegar and hot sauce.
Oh, you made your own buffalo sauce.
Hey, man, this is the real deal. You can buy everything. You could go buy fried chicken, but no, I made it. And then I made the blue cheese sauce. And because
the blue cheese sauce is delicious.
Oh, good. You know, that is made with yogurt. So this is my nod to health. Instead of sour cream, you could go either way.
The healthiest buffalo wings you've ever had.
Potentially.
And baked and with yogurt blue cheese dip.
I know. It's going to sound odd, but it tastes close to the real deal, I think.
That's Kathy Gunst, our Here and Now resident chef, talking about fried chicken. We've got all the recipes she's been talking about, including for the blue cheese dip, at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
General Electric shares opened sharply higher this morning on news that the company has removed CEO John Flannery. GE has struggled with a number of challenges, and according to sources, the board was frustrated by the slow pace of change under his leadership. Flannery's replacement is Larry Culp, a former CEO of the life sciences company Danaher. Joining us now is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So, tough day for John Flannery, but gone after less than a year on the job. What's behind this?
You know, this is a company that was really trying to change direction. It came in with too much debt to the financial crisis, not enough growth. It recently got kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and it's been quite a turnaround. This is a company that really was sort of the symbol of manufacturing, then became the symbol of, like, the great American conglomerate. And frankly, it's been shrinking since the financial crisis. And if you look at the performance just over the last year, the stock's down by almost 48% from a year ago. So was really going to be tough for Flannery to keep his job for much longer unless he showed significant results.
Which apparently he did not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, this is a company that I should say that, you know, he had a tough job coming in, right? So they're going to sell off major units, healthcare, transportation, oil and gas. And this happened after the company downsizing spun out its financial arm, GE Capital. So I really think that it was tough, but clearly he wasn't going fast enough for the board of directors, even understanding the constraints that he came into the job facing.
So the new CEO is Larry Culp, who's been on GE's board for several months, although he is the first outsider ever to run GE. What else can you tell him about us?
Well, you know, he is the CEO of that conglomerate, which is a much smaller company than GE was. He served as the CEO from 2001 until early 2015. He was a very young CEO. He came into that job when he was 37. He is really into this concept called lean manufacturing. He's also seen as a pretty major league deal maker. In his tenure at the firm, the shareholder return was 465% compared with about 105% for the S&P 500 during the same time. I guess that maybe the board looks at Culp as perhaps someone who could really successfully navigate the downsizing of a conglomerate and the focus that is necessary to build business units where essentially you can make money. Really focusing those efforts is important.
GE also said it would take a goodwill charge as large as $23 billion for its struggling power division. What does that mean?
That's one of those great sayings on Wall Street that sounds like, oh, it's goodwill. Like, I've got goodwill. And what it really means is you've really cratered on that unit and you missed your profit and your cash targets. And by the way, this charge is essentially saying we goofed. We are losing more money in this. This is probably associated to the 2015 acquisition of the power business of Francis Alstom, which was a lot of people thought this was going to build up GE's power business, you know, get back to its roots. But obviously this has backfired. Global demand for power generation declined. And, you know, that's a $23 billion error that's hardly goodwill in my book, but that's what they call it in accounting.
It's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, is GE going to get back into the Dow, you think?
I don't think so. That's my big guess for that.
Thank you.
Take care.
In Washington state, the number of school-age children who are homeless is way up. The Seattle Times recently found that in several rural and suburban areas, the homeless student population had more than doubled between 2012 and 2017. And statewide, the number is up 34% in the past 5 years. Across the country, about 1.3 million homeless students are enrolled in public schools. But why is this happening at a time when unemployment is below 4% and the economy is booming? Well, it turns out that may be part of the problem. Carly Capetto is Family Resource Coordinator for Bethel Schools District in Pierce County, Washington, one of the districts trying to figure all of this out. Carly, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Those numbers are shocking. What are you seeing there in Pierce County?
Thank you for having me.
Those numbers are shocking. What are you seeing there in Pierce County?
We definitely have seen a significant rise of our homeless families in the last few years. 2 years ago, we had about 350 homeless students enrolled. Just this last year, we enrolled 759 homeless students.
Wow.
This year, we don't have a total tally yet, but I can tell you right now, we're well ahead of the numbers that we had last year.
Do you have any idea why?
Yeah, I go out in the field and I speak with these families. I see these families and it's very difficult to meet with them. You have to go out to see them to really understand the layers of the onion that these families are going through. There's multiple layers of it. But I truly believe back in 2014, when we had our economy boom, we never saw rental prices as high as $1,400. You used to be able to get a small apartment or a rental unit for, you know, $1,000, $1,100, $1,200. Since then, rentals have gone up. It is a lot more difficult to find Section 8 housing and affordable housing for these families, especially if you are a working family and you work a minimum wage job at $12 an hour, 40 hours a week. Your income is going to be about $1,900 for the month, and then $1,400 of that's going to be going towards rent. So that doesn't leave you a lot for crisis that happen. There's many different factors that are leaving these families just on the edge of becoming homeless. And really, it's a matter of, and once that happens, then they're on the streets.
Now, you are just outside of Tacoma, Washington, not far from Seattle, one of the most expensive cities in the country. Are you seeing an issue where people are getting priced out of a place like Seattle, and then they're coming your way and they still can't afford housing? Is that what you're noticing?
Yes, absolutely. We are known for a bedroom community, is what they're calling us. A lot of families are coming out to our area to find the $1,400 rentals or as cheap as they can, and they will commute as far as 2 hours to work on a daily basis. And like I said, it just takes a loss of a job or that one crisis, or they didn't have money saved up for an incident that happens before things start to crumble underneath them.
And it's a symptom of the good economy, which is the most fascinating thing about this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So for an elementary school kid who is homeless in your district, what is a typical day like?
It's very challenging. First off, there are families that aren't even getting identified because they don't want to be identified. They're afraid if they tell anyone that they're living in their car, that their children will be taken away from them. It could be their immigration status that they're afraid of being identified from. So really, a lot of the homeless families that we have, those children go without until we get them recognized. We recognize them through a variety of just being aware and paying attention to our students at school, which students are getting lunch, which students are sitting without lunch, which kids are on the chronic absentee list, who's coming late, tardy to school every day.
And you notice that, and then what do you do? Do you sit them down and ask them what's going on at home? Do you...
Yeah, it's, you know, I find my role becoming an investigator because they won't come to you. You have to go to them, and you have to be very gentle with it. I go out in my community and I do drive-bys to go to the address that they have listed in our system just to see kind of what the house is like. A lot of times I just go out to the house and cold knock on the door. They totally don't even expect me, but it's just, you know, they're not responding to me. And I just want to ask them in a gentle way, you know, hey, I'm here for you. How can I support you? And a lot of times at that moment, they will just pour in and just explain everything. And then it's building a relationship from there to get them the services they need to address the barriers they're experiencing.
It's not just your state of Washington. It's a lot of other states, especially across the West. I'm seeing reports out of Idaho. They've got the highest number of homeless students they've seen in years. There's a report out recently about a jump in homeless school kids outside of Anchorage, Alaska. This is in many places around the country. Do you think it's the same root cause in each one of these places or something different?
It's very hard to say. I mean, each family's story is different. Each demographic is different. Employment rates are different. But I would say it has to be directly correlated with just housing prices going up. And we haven't really seen any new shelters or funds being set aside for Section 8 housing to accommodate the massive boom in these homeless families. It's like we're not keeping up with the need.
So what kind of help are you getting?
We, Bethel School District is not connected to a city title, so it's very difficult to have the resources and the funds that we need. So we require solely on our own community to provide funding and donations. I believe Bethel, we're a model for a lot of school districts serving our homeless families because we have systems set up where we have a resource bus we drive. We go out to the community. We do food drops. We bring them clothing that they need. Sometimes we've even brought medical supplies such as wheelchairs out to families that they need. We have a food program where we send food packs home with every homeless student on Fridays, so they have food for the weekend until they get back to school on Monday. We have multitudes of faith leaders that have pooled together to help solve our problem out here. And it's wonderful and we're well supported, but it's it's like a Band-Aid to every crisis that's happening.
And it sounds like you're saying it's private mm-hmm. citizens stepping in to fill the gaps. It's not the government yes. coming in to do it.
It's private citizens. It's our team at Bethel. It's our hard work and community leaders that we have that have recognized the need and have wanted to help.
The big picture, of course, is that this makes it very hard for kids to succeed in school. And there's a lot of data out there that back that up. There's one study that says kids who experience homelessness in school are 87% more likely to drop out of high school. And as you well know, it then becomes this cycle of poverty. You see this mm-hmm. every day in your job. I mean, how does that look to you on the ground to see how these kids then struggle with their classwork?
It's just heartbreaking to work with the families and work with the students. Their self-worth and their self-value and what they believe they are capable of doing is so low that it debilitates them from doing potentially well in what they potentially could be. I'll just give you an example. I had one young man I was working with, and he had no self-value, could care less about doing his school. And I had asked him, I said, what do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, I'll probably just end up like my parents and be on the streets. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, you can be something different. I said, what do you enjoy? So after a couple meetings with him over the next week, I had discovered that he loved animals. So it was simple as hooking him up to a veterinarian that took the young man under his wings and started showing them the ropes of what education you need to become a veterinarian doctor. And here, why don't you come after school and help volunteer and clean the kennels for me and do this? It gave that boy purpose to have a hope and a dream after high school. And that's all I can offer for these students, is giving them the hope and the dream that they can be somebody after high school other than what they've experienced.
Carly Capetto, a family resource coordinator with the Bethel School District in Pierce County, Washington, which has been dealing with a spike in the number of homeless kids enrolled in their schools. Carly, thanks for the work that you do, and thanks for speaking mm-hmm. with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Meanwhile, oceans away, the North Atlantic right whale is closer to extinction than it's been in decades. In the last year and a half, at least 19 of these school bus-sized whales have died, most bearing scars from fishing gear or ship strikes. There are an estimated 450 North Atlantic right whales left, but after nearly 50 years on the endangered species list, marine biologists predict the species will be gone in another two decades. While much attention has been paid to the dying whales, some biologists say the whales' real problem is something different: low birth rates. Reporter Miriam Wasser has our story.
To hear Charles Stormy Mayo talk about right whales is to hear a man on a mission. A mission to understand one of the ocean's most powerful and bizarre mammals.
They are odd looking. They don't actually look at all like a whale. When you first see them, you won't know what you're looking at.
Sitting in his Provincetown, Massachusetts living room, Mayo tells me right whales look like barnacle-covered rocks.
They have giant mouths, and then they have immense and very lovely sculpted tails. But I think more important is the aura they create, which is of an animal that's rife with mystery.
These days, the right whale mystery is whether the species will survive. As the director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, Mayo has watched over the last year and a half or so as dead right whales have washed up on shore or been found floating in the water.
The trajectory of the population from the latest data is pointing towards zero.
And right whale experts say it's not just that the whales are dying prematurely. They're also not reproducing. Heather Pettis is with the New England Aquarium.
We've seen variable reproduction over the years, but nothing like what we've seen this year.
Pettis says right whales can calve every 3 to 4 years. Of the 70 or so that could have given birth this year, zero did. That's right, zero. Researchers think there are two big reasons for the declining birth rates: nutrition and stress.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Would you like to chat?
Sure.
Cool.
To understand the first part, okay. I meet with researcher Dan Pendleton at the New England Aquarium. His specialty is copepods, the tiny zooplankton that whales eat.
Gosh, they look a little bit like a tiny shrimp with a bulbous body that holds an oil sac, and that's the reason that they're targeted as prey, is because they're oily and they're fatty.
Copepods can't really swim. They rely on ocean currents to move them around, and climate change is sending them into new territory.
We think that changes in temperature and circulation have essentially shifted the areas where copepods are.
Heather Pettis says climate change might also be affecting the copepod's size and fat content.
There's some thought that shifts in the timing of copepod reproduction and perhaps disruption of their cycle, that's impacting their nutritive quality.
And like all animals, female right whales need to have a certain amount of fat stored up to reproduce.
And so if these females are energetically stressed because they're traveling farther to find food and their food resource is not high quality, they're not going to build that necessary energetic reserve to get pregnant and carry an offspring to term.
Their shifting food source also increases another risk, entanglements. Right whales are now showing up in areas that have more fishing activity than their old feeding grounds. And whales that get caught up in fishing gear struggle to swim and feed properly. That causes stress. And stress, according to researchers, is the second major factor in the low birth rate hypothesis. Another source of stress? The near constant man-made noise in the ocean. This is what a large ship sounds like underwater, at 2 miles away. Here's a wind turbine. In 2012, researchers published a paper showing for the first time that this acoustic smog is directly correlated to higher stress levels in right whales. Back at the New England Aquarium, researcher Heather Pettis acknowledges that the North Atlantic right whale's prospects are dim, but they're not necessarily doomed.
We know that this is a very resilient population. If we just give them a break, if we can reduce some of these immediate pressures, such as entanglement in fixed fishing gear and collisions with ships, I think we know exactly what we need to do. We just need to do it.
In some right whale habitats, state and federal rules limit fishing activity or where ships can go and how fast. Pettis says more regulation is needed. Whether that can happen before it's too late, she says that's the big question. For Here and Now, I'm Miriam Wasser.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.